Is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, March 27th, 2026. I'm Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on Rabble Radio, we're sharing a small clip from the latest episode of the Courage My Friends series, featuring Kara Anderson from Mining and Justice Solidarity Network and Rachel Small from World Beyond War. Alongside Courage My Friends host, Resh Bidou, Kara and Rachel discuss Canada's radical turn toward militarism and its ramping up of defense spending. They also discuss the many and deep connections between militarism and mining in the mining capital of the world and solidarity organizing against the march to war. Here is a clip of that conversation. Take a listen.
Kara, welcome. And Rachel, welcome back. Kara, tell us about the Mining Injustice Solidarity Network.
The Mining Justice Solidarity Network, also known as MISN, is a grassroots collective organizing here in Toronto, which we consider to be the belly of the beast or the global capital for mining, because many of the mining companies are headquartered here in Vancouver and they often trade on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And so our focus is on supporting communities on the front line, respecting their right to say no and respecting their sovereignty.
Thank you. And Rachel, welcome back again, and tell us about World Beyond War.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be here. So World Beyond War is a global network and grassroots movement to abolish war, shut down the military-industrial complex, and build alternatives together. So here across so-called Canada, I work to end the violence of Canadian militarism, really in solidarity. I think the common theme of this interview might be about solidarity, but yeah, really in solidarity with everyone who's kind of facing down the barrel of the violence of Canadian militarism and really its growing partnership with the U.S. war machine. So we work in solidarity, I mean, right this month, in folks from Iran to Sudan to Palestine to the Congo to Venezuela and Cuba, and really trying to look at where is Canadian militarism causing harm and what can we do to end that.
Thank you. And there's a lot of work for you to do right now, and we're going to get into that. So Canada's global brand has largely revolved around its reputation as a peacekeeping, middle power, and defender of human rights. And in some ways, this is merited, but this is also quite rightly challenged. Kara, give us some more background on Canada's role in global mining.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that with Canada being the kind of global headquarter for mining, mining is necessary for conflict. So a lot of times Canada's role is kind of eclipsed from the conversation. And I think it's really important to recognize this right now. Recently attending like a federal event at the PDAC, which is the largest mining convention in the world, they were talking about how they're really trying to reform their former status as like a mining superpower. And this is all coming alongside where we're seeing like an insane increase in defense budgets, oftentimes using the language of critical minerals to kind of hide the fact that a lot of this will be used for defense and not necessarily for everyday consumption. And so I think too, when we think of like militarism, we also need to think about like mining militarism supply chains and how oftentimes, even if Canada isn't the one initiating conflict, they're a huge part as to like why these conflicts can move forward with their ongoing ability to supply critical minerals. And specifically with the U.S. right now. So there's the Canada-U.S. Joint Plan on Critical Minerals, and it's to address mineral security concerns. And it's basically to ensure that both countries have consistent access to critical minerals. Also, too, there's a newer initiative, with G7 countries to boost critical mineral access for select foreign partners in the name of collective defense.
Right. And this is coming along a backdrop of years of really problematic mining behaviors that are connected to Canada, really human rights violations that have been happening globally. So could you just go a bit more into how big a mining footprint Canada has globally, particularly, I think, in Latin America and Africa?
Yeah, so I think it's important to start with the fact that most of the juniors in the world junior mining companies in the world are Canadian. That's where they get funding. And so junior mining companies are the people who basically prepare land for the creation of a mine. And then later on, larger mining companies, which are known as senior mining companies like Rio Tinto, will come in and buy this land. And so there's a lot of violence that goes into preparing a mine site. First and foremost, kind of selecting an area, which oftentimes they don't have access to. In countries like Canada, it's actually really easy to just simply go online and get a permit and go in places like Quebec and start sampling without any consultation. Same thing in Ontario. And then oftentimes, once they kind of identify a mineral deposit, they'll start bringing in construction equipment, and they want that construction equipment protected. So they'll bring in like militarized security forces to start protecting that. And then when communities start figuring out what's going on and dissenting, they often use violence to shut them up. So in Guatemala, and particularly with the Escobal mine, which is currently owned by Pan American Silver, the Xinka community has been in resistance for several years, and they've used different tactics like, you know, threatening frontline defenders. Some of them have had to leave their communities for safety reasons. So that's kind of like some of the violence you have before a mine actually happens. And then once there's equipment there, things ramp up because mining companies need to protect the profit. So they oftentimes collude with local police forces and bring in militarized police forces. In places like Guatemala, we see kind of ex-military officials who were involved in the state-led genocide are often now heads of security for these mining companies. So we have violence at different stages as well. And again, the idea is to kind of protect profit as much as possible.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, under the Carney government, we're seeing, as Cara was just saying, a massive increase in defense spending. And he just announced a further $35 billion for Arctic defense. Rachel, what does this pivot to militarism look like? And what does it mean? Is this new or just an acceleration of something that was already happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. Maybe just to bridge it by kind of jumping on the last one, I think it's important to note that Canada is a country that's built on the removal of Indigenous people from their land for resource extraction. That's the foundational war of Canada. That's how this country was created. And that's also what Canada's global relations overwhelmingly look like. So when we're talking about Canadian mining companies around the world, like, it's that continuation of that same pattern of colonization. And as Cara said, that violence can play out in many, many different ways. You can remove people from their land by poisoning the land and the water, through economic coercion, through literally the assassination of anyone who stands up to a Canadian mining project, through supporting the militarization of a region. Canada is very rarely sending in Canadian troops to securitize a mine, but is much more frequently supporting really violent and oppressive regimes to do that dirty work for a Canadian mining company. And then the cycle sort of continues. All this violence is required in order to evict people from their land so that there can be a mine. And then increasingly, as Cara said, what is being mined is like literally the ingredients of the most horrific weapons on the planet. I think we've all been watching over the past couple of years as F-35, the most advanced warplane in the world, have just decimated Gaza. Like, the most advanced warplanes are being used to burn people alive in their tents, people who have no means of defending. It's a very dystopian scene. Every single one of those F-35s has over 900 pounds of these rare earth minerals that are very reliant on Canadian mining. So we're using violence to make these mines, and then these mines are required for the war machine. And then what's mined is being used to enact violence on other people all over the world. Like, it's a really horrific cycle. I mean, not to mention that like a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions around the world are literally from mining. There are so many ways in which the Canadian mining industry is just truly at the heart of the most destructive forces on the planet, and is like literally making an unlivable planet for everybody, from a climate perspective, from a war and violence perspective, from a theft of Indigenous land perspective, et cetera. So at this point, like, you really can't separate Canadian mining from the military-industrial complex. And I'm really glad that we're having this conversation for that reason, because I think it's really poorly understood, that connection. Right. That said, as you mentioned, the Carney government has become ever more clear about these connections. And I mean, if you took a look at the 2025 budget for this country. Militarism is embedded in every part of it, and they're no longer pretending.
And it's called Canada Strong, right? Yes. So it really sort of exemplifies this military term. Yeah.
And there's all types of strength, and there could be strength through like investing in what our communities need for be strong, in health, in education, in really ambitious nation-building projects that are not about like strength through violence and militarism. But unfortunately, that is not the path that he has chosen. And they're not even pretending anymore that critical mineral mining is for like electric vehicles or whatever. I mean, there's various things that it could be used for, but they've become just brazenly clear, like, no, this is about supplying the biggest defense companies on the earth who like rely on these minerals to make these dystopian weapons. So yeah, I mean, what we're looking at now is Carney really pushing an agenda for Canada that's about economic prosperity and foreign policy and domestic policy built on militarism and war. And this is actually like a pretty radically new path for Canada. And overwhelmingly, what that whole path is relying on is on moving Canada closer and closer to the US militarily. So on one hand, despite talking in the election campaign and his Davos speech, et cetera, about, I don't know, elbows up, about separating from the US, about standing up to resisting these big bullies, what he's actually done is move Canada horrifyingly, like at breakneck speed, down a path that really is based on ever-increasing militarization and warmongering in lockstep with the US. And I think if this wasn't like clear enough before, the past few weeks have really just laid it completely bare with the Canadian government's full-throated support for Israel and the U.S.'s just like horrific and wildly illegal bombings of Iran, starting now a new regional war. And the government refused in any way to separate itself from this kind of new edge of U.S. war making. And of course, we've seen this too in their refusal to act in the face of U.S.'s invasion of Venezuela, ongoing campaign of starving Cuba. Like there's talk on one hand of, oh, we're doing our own thing, and then zero interest in actually doing that. I mean, there's been new kind of defense announcements coming out every couple weeks or more often sometimes. And just a few weeks ago was this new defense industrial strategy was released, literally throwing around $500 billion to ramp up military production and arms exports in the country, to weaken already dysfunctional permitting processes. And like I said, really banking Canada's future on economic prosperity through militarism and war profiteering, including ramping up arms exports 50%, et cetera. And I should say, these numbers are like complete fiction. Like they're made up. They're a fantasy. You can't say, oh, we're going to ramp up our arms exports by 50%. No matter how many billions of dollars you're throwing on it, you have no way of knowing that other countries are going to buy the increased production, especially at this global moment of a ramped up arms race where all these countries are also investing in their own domestic production. So even from a financial economic perspective, it's a fantasy and it's really hard to believe these numbers are going to play out. But it's also just a completely morally bankrupt strategy and approach.
Well, so I just want to go back a bit, because Prime Minister Carney has been making waves at home and globally. So you mentioned his January 20th speech, the World Economic Forum in Davos went viral because he called for finally middle powers to unite in a shift away from the old rules-based international order and domination of hard power, aka the United States. But then, as you said, we've seen his implicit support for U.S. aggressions against Venezuela and Iran, though he did backtrack on the latter. So a question for you both, and we've been talking about this, but really to put it down, who is Carney and who is this new liberal government? So Cara, who is this government?
I would describe this government as like they say one thing and do the opposite. I think it's really interesting what you're saying about like how Canada is in lockstep, what Rachel is saying. But even a few weeks ago at the PDAC conference, they had this whole Invest Canada thing, and the Ministry of Energy was there, Tim Hodgkins. And his whole shtick was that we are not the US. This is why you should be investing in with us. We will never use our mineral supply to like blackmail other countries. Like we're the good guys. And so I think it's like really important to understand that they're continuing to frame themselves as distinct from the US and trying to really create that separation. But at the end of the day, their actions speak otherwise. So it's really hard to, I think, trust anything that they do say, especially when their actions just say quite the opposite.
Right. And so again, in terms of this Canada Strong Budget 2025, It's very interesting the way in which military investment is being used. Yeah, it's about defense and protecting our sovereignty, but it's also economic stimulus and a great job creation plan. And some are describing this as sort of a military Keynesianism.
I mean, there's a way in which Carney was kind of an unknown entity, like obviously somebody who was, you know, in the public space and quite visible on the global stage, but as a banker. And I mean, he's clearly still a banker, but he's been in power now a year. So I think we can at this point feel like we have some evidence of what him and this government is all about. I mean, to me, he's kind of like a wolf in sheep's clothing. He presents and talks, as Carr said, in a particular kind of way, but his policies, his actions, the laws that he's trying to pass, like it's very Trumpian. Like it's really moving us down a very, very similar path as the U.S. in terms of the redistribution of public funds just straight up towards militarism and towards the same U.S. war companies.
And also the immigration policies that we were talking about when you were here earlier, right? C2.
Exactly. Yeah. And in terms of cutting back the public sector, like robbing the country of what is actually needed to address the actual security threats that face people in this
country. Say more about that, because you're talking about the social costs of this military buildup.
Yeah. I mean, if you're looking at what is actually like killing people in Canada now and certainly projected increase in the future, like things like climate change and ecological collapse, certainly disease epidemics, public health emergencies, but also really just like poverty coupled with the ballooning costs of housing and food, a lack of access to health. Like this is what are the security threats for many millions of people across Canada right now. And when we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars increasingly on like these outrageous, aggressive, and like wildly overpriced weapon systems, like the Golden Dome, for example, which is a pure fantasy in Trump's mind, I think it's a slap in the face to everyone in Canada who's currently struggling to get by, who can't even imagine a life for their children in a country, frankly, that sets new wildfire records nearly every year. Like this is more and more money being pulled away from the immediate survival needs of people. And we're not even talking about like visionary future planning. Like we are in climate collapse and crisis right now. And to be pulling even just the small amount of funds that was devoted to that away to invest it in war, it's brutal. And I think that these decisions, unfortunately, are like super long term. Like just like when you build a pipeline, you're entrenching a future of oil extraction and climate crisis, right? Like you're not just building a pipeline just in case. That's you kind of committing to what the future of the country is going to look like from an oil perspective. So similarly, when Carney is deciding that we're going to ramp up Canada's military budget, we're going to escalate a global arms race, we're going to purchase all these new warships, fighter jets, space missiles, which is what the Golden Dome is, that's a commitment to wage war via these weapon systems for decades to come. That means that Canada's foreign policy strategy is going to be based on fighter jets and warships and dropping bombs versus any ideas about diplomacy or peace building. They do not buy these tools and then not use them. They're not just in case tools. Like this is a decision, oh, this is how we're going to engage in the world. And that's really scary that they're making a promise really of a war-filled future.
Absolutely. And when Carney is talking about this, I mean, he's talking about our defense spending. It's going up. We're going to be protecting our borders, all of that. He's also been promoting Canada as a resource powerhouse. You know, we've got to diversify our trading partners. Hey, everybody, come to Canada. We have all of these resources, which is true. We are a very resource-rich Canada. Kara, how are you hearing this when we are being promoted this way?
Yeah, so I think a quote from the Energy Minister is actually really telling. He told investors that it would be a shame not to take advantage of the current crisis and a shame not to invest at this Investment Canada thing. Essentially, it was built on this whole idea that Canada has this infinite capacity to develop resources. They just needed some government spending to do that. And now that they're receiving all this cash, that they are ready to go. I think the other thing to recognize too is that it's not just kind of like exploring, but Canada wants to ramp up their ability to produce, kind of process the minerals. They want to build more midstream and downstream processing for mining. So it's not just exploration at this point. Because again, if you build midstream and downstream, that is where like the high value adding steps are. And right now those are being exported to other countries. And this way too, Canada's kind of trying to like close their own production cycle and being able to essentially create these like high value minerals and then being able to use them as they please. So I think internally too, we are seeing kind of like a bolstering of their own infrastructure and their ability to follow through on some of this stuff.
Right. And as was brought up earlier, there is a severe ecological price to be paid for that. But we rarely talk about the climate and ecological impacts of militarism and of mining abroad, since we only track mining emissions within borders and military emissions we don't track at all. So back to you, Kara. Talk about the climate price of all of this, and can we even know the full extent of it?
No, there's no way to know, unfortunately, at this point. So we have things like when you contaminate a waterway, right? So there are more immediate effects, like what that does to the environment, what that does to local ecosystems, what that does to humans. Maybe you'll see like an increase in urinary tract infections. But unfortunately, too, a lot of the long-term effects of this stuff are only now just starting to be understood. And also, too, right, like you're not just taking away people's ability to live right now, you're taking away their ability to live in the future. If they don't have access to water, then they can't participate in agriculture. If they lose access to certain lakes or ports, right, then they can't go fishing. And so thinking about this everyday cost of how these climate issues kind of trickle in to all these areas of everyday life. And then I think the other thing too, like when you have giant open pit mines in the ground, you can't heal from that. Like there is no restoration that can be done, at least within the current infrastructure. And so communities, they either have to leave or they have to kind of figure out ways to build life within these dystopian places that are very much like sacrifice zones. And again, a lot of their governments have no interest in actually supporting restoration. And these foreign companies, specifically Canadian mining companies, are not held to any standards in terms of how to clean up their mines. The other thing to understand is that mining prices and the prices of ores kind of fluctuate. So sometimes mines will stop for a bit and then they'll restart and then they'll stop and then maybe they'll have like an expansion or maybe they won't. When they kind of stop randomly and they think maybe they're going to come back and then they don't end up coming back, there's kind of no way to hold them accountable for that either. So the closing of mines is also kind of problematic in that regard.
Who are some of the major mining companies?
So we have Barrick Gold, we have Rio Tinto, we have Red Giant Copper, Vale. There's so many.
Yeah, I think what Kara said here is really important. The overlap between the disasters and progress of like militarism and climate crisis is enormous. And the climate crisis is in large part both caused by and being used as an excuse for increasing war making and militarism.
How is it being used as an excuse for? Just to clarify that.
So the presumed threat of borders being flooded by...
That was Kara Anderson from Mining Injustice Solidarity Network and Rachel Small from World Beyond War, in conversation with Courage My Friends podcast series host, Resh Bidu. To listen to the full episode from this series, head over to Rabble Radio's sister podcast, Needs No Introduction, home of the Courage My Friends podcast series. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's hand things over to Rabble editor, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with world news. U.S.-based humanitarian organization Oxfam is warning of a growing crisis in Lebanon. For weeks now, Lebanon has been under attack from Israeli forces, who say they are targeting members of Hezbollah, who are allies of Iran. Oxfam says Israel is destroying civilian infrastructure in Lebanon, leading to a worsening humanitarian crisis. Israel has damaged or destroyed much of the water infrastructure in Lebanon, leaving tens of thousands at risk of losing access to clean drinking water. Oxfam points out that targeting civilian infrastructure like access to water is against the Geneva Convention. In provincial news this week, Ontario Premier Doug Ford has been served with a libel notice from the City of Toronto Al-Quds Committee. The nonprofit organization organizes the annual Al-Quds Day event in March of each year in the city. Al-Quds Day is a global day of protest in solidarity with the Palestinian people. In advance of the event, Ford made statements where he falsely claimed that the event supported terrorism and had led to violence and arrests in previous years. Ford had directed his attorney general to file an injunction against the Al-Quds Day event in Toronto to stop it from happening. An Ontario Superior Court judge found Ford's reasoning for blocking the event to be baseless and allowed it to go ahead. Now, the Al-Quds Committee is calling on Doug Ford to retract his defamatory statements against the event and has given him 1 week to do so, or they will escalate their legal action against the premier. In labor news this week, organizations representing farmers, like the National Farmers Union, are calling on the federal government to reverse its decision to close 7 agricultural research facilities across the country. The closures are coming as a part of Prime Minister Mark Carney's plan to shrink the federal government. But advocates for the facilities say that the closures would have a negative impact on the country's agricultural sector. As farming continues to feel pressure from tariffs and climate change, losing the research provided by these facilities could leave farmers facing an underprepared future. A letter signed by the National Farmers Union reads, quote, "These cuts threaten the science, research, and innovation needs of our sector as it currently prepares for one of the biggest challenges it has ever faced." End quote. Also this week, economist Jim Stanford argues that despite being under pressure from the U.S. for decades, the Cuban economy is resilient and in many ways has overperformed. A nation's economy is usually measured by its gross domestic product, or how much wealth it generates, and Cuba's is relatively small, but the country has done well at efficiently providing for its citizens. The average life expectancy in Cuba is similar to that of the U.S., and literacy rates in the country are high. Despite lower than average wages compared to other Caribbean and South American countries, Cuba's Human Development Index, which measures quality of life, is slightly higher than those comparators. Stanford argues that despite the U.S.'s best efforts to destroy Cuba through economic means, the country has found a way to persevere. And finally, in environmental news, First Nations and farmers in northeastern Alberta are calling on the province and federal government to conduct an environmental assessment of a proposed carbon capture project in their area. The province is proposing to capture carbon emissions generated from the Alberta oil sands and pump it underground beneath farmland and land owned by the Athabasca Chippewa First Nation. Chief Alan Adam of the Athabasca Chippewa First Nation expressed his concerns at a press conference, saying, quote, "We will make sure this project gets through environmental review from the Canadian government, or else we will launch legal actions against the federal government and the Alberta government for allowing this to happen when it shouldn't." End quote. And as always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.